Welcome to episode 15 of Reading the Game. This episode we're going to be talking about the Wax Pack and the open road in search of baseball's afterlife by Brad Baloochian. A fantastic and warm read all about Brad's journey across America, tracking down the retired baseball players who featured in a single pack of Topps baseball cards from 1986. I was lucky enough to speak to Brad about his process and bringing the book to publication, and that's the first audio segment of this podcast. When we come back from that, you're going to be hearing a discussion that Phil and I had with Rob Navera from Bat Flips and Nerds, and incidentally, Rob himself recorded an interview with Brad, which served as an episode of Bat Flips and Nerds, which you should definitely go and track down if you haven't already heard. And also, we spoke to Bubba on Baseball, who is something of a baseball card collector and aficionado, and he brought some insight into the book. So the first part you'll hear is the chat with Brad. The second part is the roundtable discussion between myself and Phil and Rob and Bubba. And I began by asking Brad to kick us off by telling us about how he came to write the book.
So I have for a long time wanted to write something long, like book length, and the type of journalism that I trained in was called magazine journalism or creative nonfiction, narrative nonfiction. I had written a lot of shorter things and wanted to be able to do something where I got to actually practice that craft. And I was always fascinated by baseball, and as a kid collected baseball cards, and my favorite players were the guys that were not the superstar players. So I had all my favorites as a kid, and I always wondered what happened to those guys long after they were done playing. You know, it's a common theme of where are they now sort of theme that often gets done. And so I was thinking about ways to explore that, and I had the idea that if I got a single pack of cards from the time of my childhood, that would create the perfect device to get this random sample of players, most of whom are going to be those underdog types, and have a chance to actually answer that question about what happened to them after they were done playing. And so taking it another step and thinking about what would make for the most entertaining read, I thought there's nothing better than a quest or a journey and a road trip. You know, road trips go just hand in hand with baseball. And so I thought, what if I structured an actual book around the road trip itself, the trip itself, and told the story of not just the players, but my experience trying to track them down.
It's a remarkable road trip that you go on. I love how you tally the cups of coffee over the course of the journey. I was, my sabermetric head, I was trying to tally the number of cups of coffee per mile over the course of your journey. It was quite interesting seeing how it spiked at certain points, which is quite
great,
interesting.
That's great.
One of the more remarkable things about the book is that you conducted the trip, I believe, without a book deal or any backing from publishers. And I know it took a long time after finishing, after the story elapsed, to bring the book to publication. Can you talk a bit about how the book eventually came to be published and how it felt when you actually managed to get it published?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked that, because the process is often more difficult than the writing. This is my first time writing a book. I learned a lot about the publication industry in the United States, how challenging it is. There's basically five companies, they call them the big five, that control all the major publishing in the US. And if you have any chance of getting a book deal that's at all financially viable, you basically have to get it from one of those five companies. And so after I took the trip, I had an agent, and we went through two different agents going out to those companies trying to get a deal. And I counted up 38 rejections from those publishing houses. And it was particularly frustrating because the rejections were not because they thought the book wasn't good or the writing wasn't good, but these sort of marketing related hangups they had, where they said, well, you don't have a giant platform, you don't have 100,000 followers on social media, so we can't justify taking a chance on you because you're an unknown writer. And you know, they want to feel absolutely certain that they're going to sell X number of books when they make a deal, which I understand to some extent, but at the same time, how do you ever discover any new voices if you never will take that chance? And, you know, I always believed in the book that I wanted to write. I had a very clear vision for it. I knew that it was going to transcend baseball and get into these bigger themes. And therefore I thought it had this, you know, amazing crossover appeal. And it frustrated me that I couldn't get one of those imprints at those publishing houses to take a chance on me. Thankfully, the University of Nebraska Press did take a chance on me, and that's where I ultimately ended up getting it published. And it's interesting, after all that, I didn't even have an agent. I didn't even need an agent to sign with the University of Nebraska because they're a much smaller press. And so then finally this April, the book came out, and, you know, it's been really satisfying. I feel kind of vindicated that to see the success of it and to see how well it's doing. You know, it hit the number one spot on Amazon for baseball books, and it's already going into its fourth printing. And so, you know, for me to see that it's right there with all the books that have the giant advances and the fancy marketing machines, to see that my book itself has become like the underdog. You know, the book is about underdogs, and it's become one itself.
It's a really cool story. It's obviously a really nice happy ending. And I completely agree with you about the book's themes. It definitely transcends the sport of baseball. It definitely has other things in there, which make it an utterly compelling read. The book itself, the journey, the road trip you mentioned, takes place over a couple of months during the summer off from your day job. But how long did it actually take to plan and prepare for that trip? It seems very seamless, obviously the writing of the book, but did it take a lot of research into the players and their careers and their lives after baseball?
Yeah, I often say that I feel like doing this kind of book, it's like the work of two books, because the book is written in that narrative nonfiction style, sort of using the techniques of novels and fiction, you know, having details and dialogue and character development and all of that. So when you write a book like this, you have to, first of all, make sure it's nonfiction, so it has to be accurate. So you have to get all the interviews transcribed, and you have to make fact check everything. So you have all of that work, and then you got to take the material and make sure it's written in this compelling way, because it's not a reference book or a dry nonfiction book. So it's sort of double duty. But yeah, I spent about 9 months before the trip doing all the research on each guy and, you know, reading up about them and figuring out what I wanted to ask them, doing the logistics of trying to get in touch with them, get them to agree to talk to me. And then afterwards, you know, have all these, this mountain of material, all my notes and interviews. And now I've got you can use, you know, 5% of what you collect in the final book. So it's, how do you take all that and get the very best out of it?
So you mentioned in the book, you mentioned a blog, right, you were writing at the time. Is that a way that you used to record and process your thoughts as you were going through? What was the idea behind the blog? Or was it something that you were already doing before you decided to embark on the journey?
No, I never blogged like that before. It's hard. I mean, every day to write something and write something good without giving away the whole story, because I knew I wanted to write the book, was challenging. It was good. It did help sort of focus my thoughts every day, and it was good material to kind of anchor the main plot points in the book. It also was, frankly, a really good marketing tool. When I was on the trip, I was trying to also generate interest and momentum on Twitter and by blogging. And so even though the book itself didn't come out for many more years, I think that blog helped set the foundation of a following that some of those people stayed with me for all these years, and I've been really grateful to them that, you know, they always stuck with me and wanting to see the whole book come to fruition.
Cool. I mean, one of the things about the book, I'm completely not surprised that it's been a successful release, because a fantastic feature of the book is its candor and its transparency. Like, there's definitely a sense that some of the people in the book are either knowingly or unknowingly benefiting from talking about themselves to you, and like, they're almost like they're telling stories they've wanted to tell for a while, or at least it comes across like that when the way that you write them down. And you yourself go into a lot of your own past, you know, you're suffering with OCD, the breakdown of a serious relationship and the situation around the breakup of your parents' marriage. Was it cathartic at all for you to experience the book and to write the book? And were you at all surprised at how open some of the wax packers were with you in their reflections?
Yeah, I was more surprised by their candor. I've always been a pretty open book, and I've done a lot of work on myself and a lot of therapy and reflection. And so I'm pretty open in my everyday life and the people that know me. I mean, it's still a big leap to go from that to putting it out for the whole world to read. But, you know, I think people are generally very respectful when you are that vulnerable. They recognize that and they appreciate that. The players, I was really pleasantly surprised by how much they were willing to open up about and reveal. And to me, that's the strength of the book. And one of the main points of the book is that, to me, real courage and strength and heroism is not really from hitting 40 home runs. It's from being able to talk about difficult things and face your fear and, you know, be honest with yourself and other people and to be in that present moment, you know, all those things that are in the book. That's really what I admire most about these guys now is stuff that doesn't really relate to their baseball careers.
And did it change the way that you think about baseball and baseball players, you know, the experience?
Yeah. And I mean, in a way it made me, this may not sound very romantic, but it made the baseball part less impressive in a healthy way. It's like, because these guys are now more relatable, you know, I think it's not necessarily a healthy thing for fans to overly worship these players because they are just people, you know, and to realize that we have a lot in common with them is powerful. And it's also, I think, a reminder that they are, you know, they're just people as well. They have feelings. You know, I think a lot about how when people go to a game and someone makes a mistake or an error and they boo them, it's like, I don't really like that. You know, I mean, it's like, 'cause, you know, even though the players may act like they don't hear the boos or they don't care, that they do. I mean, they've got feelings too, you know? And so I think it kind of humanizes them in a good way.
Definitely. They're definitely a sense that some of them, if you know, they don't have overwhelmingly positive experiences of their baseball careers throughout their baseball careers. Now, that they obviously had high points, but almost to a man, all of the people that you spoke to had some quite low lows in their baseball careers, and it was really, really interesting to hear about those. You mentioned the underdog and your passion for the underdog. Which player surprised you most in terms of differing from your preconceived ideas of what they might be like when you actually got to meet them? Because you actually had a childhood favorite, didn't you, that you went to meet? That must have been a bit crazy.
Yeah, but and he actually exceeded. I mean, if it's possible, he exceeded my expectations. Don Carmen was just such a great guy. But someone like Gary Templeton surprised me in that I thought he'd be a little more standoffish, and he was very, like, charming and friendly and open. Steve Yeager, I was surprised that he opened up about his father being an alcoholic and some of that stuff I had never read about. Who else? Al Cowens, even though he was the one player that had passed away, the stuff that his cousin and his son revealed was very telling and really incredible, about how his son had had a fist fight in the street with him, you know, a couple weeks before he died and stuff like that. And I mean, really interesting stuff that I did not expect.
And you mentioned, you know, to a lesser or a greater degree, you know, you developed these relationships with these players over an incredibly short period of time. Some of their players and especially their families were very welcoming and receptive to you. And I got the impression that you genuinely bonded with some of these guys. Do you have a favorite Wax Packer experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the 4th of July experience in Arkansas with Jaime Coconauer was really special. I mean, he treated me like I had a longtime family friend, you know, and I talk in the book, here I am playing Cards Against Humanity with him and his wife and all of their longtime friends, as if I had always been there, right? And that was really, that was a really special, I'll never forget that 4th of July. Just feeling really, you know, even though I'm not, I don't tend to get that lonely, there were moments on the trip that were lonely and long. And that was kind of a nice moment of feeling part of this family. That was really nice.
Okay, then, and in a similar vein to the previous question, was there one wax packer with whom you wish things had perhaps gone a bit differently?
Well, I think I wish I had been able to talk to Gary Pettis, for example. His, you know, his coach, his manager said he didn't want anyone talking to the press. The guys that I didn't really get to talk to, like Gooden and Fisk and Coleman, you know, actually, I think the book is better for not having talked to them because it created some conflict and some tension in the narrative. So even though I set out wanting to find everyone, it probably worked better for the book to not find everybody. I wish Richie Hebner I had more time with. I felt like he was a little bit guarded, but probably because he was in the middle of the season and he's on the road. So, but you know, they had a game that night. So I understand where he was coming from.
So I'm glad you mentioned Carlton Fisk, because that scene with you trying to track him down at the golf club, pretending to be interested in buying property and manically cleaning out burger joint leftover trash from the seat of your beat up Honda Accord. Like, for me, that was something of a favorite in the book. And it kind of brings me on to the next question, really, because like two things struck me really early on in reading the book, which I just couldn't shake from my thoughts the whole time I was reading it. And really, to be honest, ever since. And first is that, like all the best ideas, it's an incredibly simple premise and yet an utterly original one. And I kind of kicked myself for not having had a similar idea. And secondly, that it has an incredibly filmic quality. It's like you've already mentioned, it's a road trip. It's a voyage of discovery. And it weaves together narrative threads with flashbacks to the 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s. And I could really see it working adapted as a screenplay. Is that something you've thought about? And how would you feel about a film adaptation?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, everyone, since the beginning of the idea, almost everyone when I tell them about it, they're like, oh, that sounds like a movie, right? And I, for all the reasons you said, I agree. It has a very, in fact, when I was writing the book, I almost envisioned it as a series of scenes in a movie that helped me. It helped me structure the book, because if you notice, every chapter has about four or five scenes, and to think about it cinematically was helpful to me as a writer. And even the very beginning, the prologue set in the factory when they're manufacturing the cards, to me, that the whole time I'm thinking, this is the opening of a movie. You know, you set 1985, go inside the factory, you see them making the cards, you could see the assembly line, and then you can imagine like a smash cut 2015 and then opening the pack. So it's been, as the book has come out and gotten some momentum, I've actually been contacted by some people in Hollywood who are interested in the rights. And so I have an agent through the publisher that's working on this, and we're also sending it out to some people that might have an interest in a baseball related project. And yeah, I've to me, like, all of that is almost, it's like kind of the cherry on top. You know, I have no interest in writing movies, or it's not my world, but I would love to see what someone who does have that expertise, what they would do with it. You know, people warn me that, oh, once you give the rights, you know, they can do whatever they want. They may change it. You may hate it. And it's like, yeah, that's true. I just have to accept that. I would love to be like a consultant on it, but it would be neat. You know, you couldn't adapt it like straight literally, because it's not structured that way. You'd have to maybe only pick a few of the players, or you'd have to pump up certain parts of the narrative. But there's a lot there. And I think maybe most important of which to me is, I think the OCD part could be a really cool thing to show on screen, because OCD has never really been portrayed in a serious way on screen. It's often done in a comedic way. But in the right hands, it could be a really rich portrayal of what OCD is like. And one of my goals in being open about OCD in the book is so hopefully to help other people feel like they're not alone, and help them deal with their OCD by raising awareness. So if the book could do that, or a movie could do that, it would be even better.
I mean, I'm so glad that you said all this, because I'm just excited at the prospect of a movie now. It'd be absolutely fantastic. Who plays Brad in the movie?
You must have thought about it. Well, you know, people, and I always feel like it's unfair. Like, that's the question I want to ask other people. You know? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would just get a kick out of seeing how that, who they'd even try to cast, you know. It would be fun.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Brad Pitt's already done his time in baseball films, so he's out.
Right.
otherwise, he'd be perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I like, you mentioned as well that how you begin the book with the manufacturing plant, you know, where the cards are actually created, and then the book finishes going back there as well, as it really nicely bookends the story. One of the things kind of been going around in my head is that this could have happened. This quest, your road trip, could well have happened 30 years prior to when it did, and it obviously happened when it did. Do you think it says something about baseball and baseball cards now that there's quite a strong likelihood that this couldn't happen in 30 years? Do you think? I mean, do you think it could? Do you think you could do this same thing, recreate it in 30 years' time, and have the same access to the players that you were able to get? And or do you think that the world and the sports changed too much from 30 years ago?
That's a great question. I think that today's players, I think given enough time, you could do it. I think you could get them to cooperate. I think you would get some different storylines. You know, I don't think that, I mean, like the players now, I think they specialize a lot earlier. They make a lot more money. They have bigger sort of cults of personality. So, and I think our society has changed in positive ways, in that I don't think the father-son thing would be quite as destructive. I think some of that was the times and those, that generation. So you might not have the same themes. Well, you'd have some of the same themes, because as long as you have people that are super famous and then lose it, that's going to be something that always is constant. But some of the other themes about the fathers and sons might not be there quite as much. So I'd be curious to see what a book 30 years from now about today's players would produce. I think you could do it. It would just be a different set of themes.
And you mentioned there the father-son thing. I mean, was that something you anticipated being a theme as it went through the book, and how quickly did you cotton on to the fact that this was going to be something that was going to be a thread that went throughout the narrative?
Well, I think after like the third or fourth guy that brought up their dad, and you know, it was sort of like Steve Yeager brought that up, and then Randy Reddy, and then Don Carmen, and then I was like, okay, this is, you know, there's something here that keeps coming up. So, but I didn't go into it knowing that. I didn't expect that. So that was just some serendipity that ended up being something that was a common pattern.
And do you think that that's something that might be unique to baseball? That kind of, that there's something inherently nostalgic and sepia tinted about baseball and childhood that might be unique to the sport?
I think the idea that your parents are instrumental in who you become is not unique to baseball. It's a universal thing, and just shows you how important parenthood is. The idea of baseball as sort of this language for fathers and sons, I think, has a lot to do with masculinity and traditionally men having a hard time communicating their feelings. So they communicate it in different ways, non-verbally, by playing catch or by sharing an experience like baseball. You know, it's certainly kind of my relationship with my dad. But I think that's changing also, in that I think men are becoming better communicators and are understanding that vulnerability is not something to run away from. But I think sports will always have a special place in the relationships between men and fathers and sons.
I wasn't expecting it, I have to be honest. Certainly, if, you know, from looking at the book and the book's cover and reading a little bit about the book, I wasn't expecting to process so many thoughts about my own role as a father. It was really interesting. I was pleasantly surprised by it. I was actually quite moved by a lot of the stories that came out. There was one in particular, and I forget the player, but he constructed a mound in the backyard, So that, for me, that was like, wow. I was, I don't know if I should say it, because it's a really good moment. I don't know if I can give it away what happens, but But that feeling, or that I was really genuinely moved when he literally just throws one pitch or catches one pitch and then he just walks off, and that's the only one he ever caught. And I just thought, wow, that, you know, I've literally got goosebumps like thinking about it now.
Well, it's one of the more rewarding things for me is getting the emails and the communication from readers who have been touched by different things, and how the book has led them to reflect on their own relationships and their own lives. And I think that's where I hope it has kind of a self-help quality to it, that it, you know, it gets you to think about your relationships, how honest you are with yourself and the people in your life, and what is your communication style like with the people around you. You know, these are all really important things that we should all be thinking about, we could all relate to. So I'm glad to hear that it sort of sparked some of these things for you.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, it transcends the sport of baseball. It's not like all the best baseball books, it's not a book about baseball.
Right, which is interesting, because when I was trying to sell it, I kept getting pushback and being told, no, make it more about baseball, take yourself out of it. You know, and I was stubborn and I said, no, I'm not, you know, I'd rather not do the book than do it in a way that I don't believe in.
Well, I'm happy that you've been vindicated on that. listen, I've got one more question left, and it's almost compulsory at the moment to mention the coronavirus and when you're doing these kind of things. So I recently chatted to Anika Oreck, and we talked about the Pandemic Baseball Book Club, which I know you've been heavily involved with. Can you talk a little bit about that and what it's been like to bring a book out during a global pandemic and some of the things you've done to circumvent the difficulties you've experienced while the industry has been locked down?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you talked to Anika, because she's great. And she's a great ambassador for what we're doing. So when several of us who had baseball books coming out realized that our book tours were going to get canceled, we all started talking, and really strangers, with each other on social media, and said, hey, let's help each other, you know, which is such a simple idea. And yet most writers don't do that. You know, writers often you see each other as competition and they're very territorial. And I always felt like there's not a limited pie here. We could all help each other out. And there's still plenty for each of us. So that's what we've been doing, is we form this club. We have a podcast and a video interview series and a website and even some swag that Anika designed. So people can go to pbbclub.com and check it out. It's been even just the community it's created, getting to talk to other baseball writers and hear their stories. I really enjoyed that.
Awesome. I'll definitely link to the website in the show notes. And it's brilliant to hear that you formed this bond with some fellow writers. It's almost like you're like the class of 2020. And that this situation will probably unite you, link you forever, which is really awesome. Fantastic. Listen, I've asked everything I want to ask. I just want to say at the end, thank you so much for coming on. It's really nice to talk to you about the book. I really, really enjoyed the book. And I hope that comes across to listeners in the interview. Thanks very much.
All right, Steve, it's been a pleasure. And thanks again.
I'm going to come to you then, Jason, and I'm going to ask you, first of all, to tell us your first impressions.
Yeah, you know, I was pretty excited about this. I saw him post on Instagram or Twitter that he was doing it. And when he talked about 86 tops, I was pretty excited to see what he was going to do, because that was the first set of cards I got as a child. So as an 11-year-old, I must have got it for a birthday present. So I remember that set exactly. I remember taking every card out, reading the front and the back. And I'm very excited to see what players he had pulled, because I knew all those guys from that era.
That's such a cool story, because I really felt like a phony, because I've never really collected baseball cards, and I really wanted to have collected baseball cards, and not just baseball cards, but this series of baseball cards, so that I would know more about the players. So I'm really glad that you have. How about you, Rob?
I came to it completely blind, if I'm honest. It was sort of recommended to me as reading, said go read this, it's interesting, and maybe I talked to Brad at the end of it. So I picked it up with completely the opposite. I mean, I, I wasn't watching baseball back in 1986. I was very, very young. It wasn't readily available in this country. So I kind of picked it up as something I was expecting it to be like sort of a history of these players, much along the lines of sort of the Cup of Coffee Club or Where Nobody Knows Your Name, that sort of thing. And so when I picked it up and opened it and started reading it, I thought, okay, maybe the guy's going to say, you know, I turned up here, spoke to whoever. But it wasn't. It was about him. It was about him and his story. And that sort of really took me by surprise because I hadn't properly read up what it was about other than this guy's going on a trip. So I was really surprised to see that it was about him and more about the cult of Brad's personality than it was the baseball players to a large extent. So first impressions were, well, what is this I'm reading? This is different.
It did feel different. And it definitely felt like... I don't know what it was that I was expecting, but it wasn't what I was expecting. And I think it was all the better for it. I think it was really warm. It was really gripping. It was a real page turner. I was really invested in it emotionally. And I really, really enjoyed it. How about you, Phil? What were your first impressions?
I thought it was good. It reminded me a lot of a book that I read about 5 or 6 years ago called Six Stickers, which was about a guy who... traveled the country, and actually no, he went abroad as well, so he traveled Europe trying to find the footballers that he didn't get to complete his like Merlin Premier League 1996 sticker album. So it was obviously very reminiscent of that. And again, like Rob has just said, that book also mixed elements of memoir and factual information as well. My initial impression of the book is that I think perhaps the book is more the book that Brad wanted or needed to write, but not necessarily 100% the one that I wanted to read. I think personally speaking, I would have preferred to have seen less memoir and more thoughts or biographies of the players themselves and read their thoughts on baseball, like the highlights of their career, the lowlights, the best or worst teammates, you know, their favorite stadiums, lessons learned, regrets. Whereas what I found actually that most of the conversations with the baseball players seemed to revolve around one of three things, which was like paternal relationships, dealing with failure, or the reasons behind failed marriages and breakups. And I thought that perhaps is more important for an author who acknowledges that they're suffering from OCD and commitment issues and whose own parents got divorced, rather than for me as somebody who approached it as a baseball fan, sort of expecting to read a bit about the history of Topps baseball cards. So yeah, perhaps I misjudged it and it surprised me in many ways.
But did it surprise you at all in a good way, or were you left wanting more? You mentioned what it was you wanted. How would Brad have gone about getting that information? Would it just from the testimony of the players themselves, or through more research, do you think?
I think a blend of both, to be honest with you. I mean, there was a line in it, and I can't remember who it was about, which chapter it was about, but where he said... He was chatting with one of the players, and he said, "We gloss over the highlights of his career, the Mets' dramatic comeback win over the Red Sox in the 1986 World Series, because what new could possibly be said about one of the most chronicled series in baseball history?" And I was like, "Yeah, I agree, but I would like to have read a little bit on that just to remind myself of the horrific Red Sox loss and the failure to end the curse."
Just to wallow in some some Red Sox pity. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, of all the people mentioned in the book, some are obviously cast in really positive light, some in a less positive light. Who do you think comes out well and who suffers a little bit? We'll start with you, Jason.
You know, I think his personal hero, Don Carmen, I think that was, you know, really kind of built up to that. You know, he went to his hometown, he went and visited, you know, where he was from and see what he was like. You know, he felt like, you know, he was someone that reminded him of himself. And when he actually did meet him, I think it was everything he hoped to be and more. You know, he really kind of took him in, really went into the sports psychology bit that he'd been doing post-career. I think a lot of guys struggle with that post-career because they don't have the baseball there. So I think they could probably meet as intellectuals. I think that was probably really exciting for him.
What about you, Rob?
I mean, it's one that when you listen to what Brad has to say, it's Jamie Coconauer was his favorite, and I found that exceptionally warm. The details of I mean, I maybe wanted more about how he ended up sat in his house playing Cards Against Humanity, which is a crazy story. How that comes to be, I don't know. And I always kind of struggle with how ballsy he was, kind of stepping, like, maybe it's the British in me, but to go into someone's house like that, who is a stranger, it's really peculiar. But I found that one really warm. And I think more because there was a break in the middle of it where the hilarity and the silliness stopped and they spent some time alone, sat in the basement talking about his wife's cancer. And I think it gave a real heart and warmth to parts of the book where were necessarily sort of skipping over the facts a little bit, and they were a little drier or a little colder. This was a really warm sort of chapter where I felt that he really engaged with Jamie and Brad himself. And I felt it was a really warm, friendly chapter that kind of, I was almost in the room with him during that bit. So I really enjoyed that part of it. I thought that was really favourable.
What about the baddies? I mean, is there anyone who's not cast in a favourable light, Phil? What do you?
I think we might all say the same answer to this one. That Carlton Fisk hasn't come across as a particularly warm.
I think ironically, the three most well-known players are the ones that come across the worst in the book. Dwight Gooden, Carlton Fisk, and Vince Coleman. I mean, obviously, doesn't get to meet any of them, and that's. That's difficult, I suppose, for him as the writer, for Brad as the writer, to actually concoct something personal with their relationship. I mean, he goes to incredible lengths to meet Carlton Fisk, but I think it is funny, the relationship he has with Carlton Fisk in the book, or the non-relationship he has with Carlton Fisk. But yeah, I wonder if there's something to the fact that the three most well-known players are the ones that he doesn't get to meet and that he doesn't necessarily cast in a particularly good light in the book. I don't know if anyone wants to say anything about that.
It's touched upon a little bit. I think in the interview with, or not the interview, but the phone call that he has with Carlton Fisk's assistant, where she just mentions that, you know, he's had so many interview requests over the years that it must take its toll a little bit. But it doesn't really explore any more than that. I can't recall.
I mean, I re-listened to the a lot of audio, basically, in this sort of research of what Brad said about the book. I think it's difficult with Carlton because, like, he doesn't have... Why should he want to talk to him? Mm. You know, there's no... we're very much on the side of the narrator, obviously. And it's a shame that he doesn't get to meet him. But it's also, I think, to the... and I think you said this, actually, Rob, in your interview that you did with Brad, which was excellent. If you haven't listened, you must go and listen to that. But you basically said that you don't want to call it a failure because it adds to the book's narrative. But yeah, there's no reason why any of them should actually want to involve themselves with the book. My next question really was about surprises, but I was saying, I have to be honest, I didn't know nearly about two-thirds of the players. So there's nothing that surprised me about them because I didn't know anything about them in the first place. And maybe you're the person to go to on this, Jason. If you knew a little bit about these players from actually collecting the series, is there anything that you were surprised about from what you expected at face value of these players?
You know, the one story that really kind of threw me was Al Collins. Like, I just did not know his backstory because he was a Mariners outfielder. I watched him play. I just really didn't know the whole history of them. And, you know, learning when he growing up in Compton, what it was like, when he went through to make it. I mean, that was incredible. That just really blew me away. You know, for me, he was a third, fourth outfielder that played for the Mariners. And as a kid, just didn't know much more about him. But, you know, to actually delve into the story, it was just amazing.
Yeah, that was one of the more interesting ones, definitely. Anyone else? I was.
Actually, what did surprise me, rather than any particular player, like subverting expectations, was how poor aftercare was. And I know we've talked about it on podcasts before, but most of the players mentioned in the book really struggled in the immediate year or 2 years after retiring, and from the sounds of it, had no help whatsoever. I'm sure that the situation may have changed, but if not, I hope that MLB are looking to centralize that kind of player aftercare. After their careers come to an end, because it is quite heartbreaking sometimes.
Definitely. I mean, there are a number of themes that run through the book, but one of them is that kind of an initial slump after retiring. You know, when these guys hang up the cleats, and then they just seem to all have a period of, you know, for some of them a matter of months, and for others, you know, a number of years, and in fact for some of them they're still going through it, where they, there's just kind of emptiness in their lives, and they can't fill the hole that's been left by being involved in baseball pretty much their whole lives, certainly their whole adult lives. There's a nice symmetry though with Don Carmen, you know, and his role as a psychologist with Scott Boras, and actually now getting involved in making sure that players are in a better place mentally when they're involved in the game. And then I imagine Phil, that there must be better aftercare. There must be things in place now to help major leaguers.
I think what you guys don't remember is, so in 86, you just had finished collusion with the owners. So there was no money for the guys. So, you know, these guys were working jobs come the winter just to kind of make the bills, you know, be paid, you know, so that, you know, there was no aftercare for that back in that time. So if you look back to, like, you know, 86, you know, guys weren't making a whole lot of money. I think, gosh, you had maybe one person making over $2 million a year back then. You know, $2 million a year gets you a poor middle reliever now.
Sure. And then that was another thing, you know, that it was interesting going and seeing what these guys are doing with their lives now, you know, almost to a man. They had to, like you said, Jason, they had to concoct a living outside of the game. And a couple of them, you know, Gary Pettis obviously still involved with the Astros. Don Carmen still involved in the game as a psychologist. And I suppose Carl Fisk doesn't have to worry too much about money, but you know, not if you here are people like Gary Templeton, you know, having to, you know, run in a restaurant with his wife, and you know, this is the kind of thing that you don't expect would happen to baseball players, major leaguers now. You know, they don't expect to see them doing this stuff in 20 or 30 years, maybe minor leaguers, you know, with their well-documented poor paying conditions, but anyone involved in major leagues for a number of years, you wouldn't anticipate them having to do this stuff, you know, years down the line. Let's move on anyway. We'll talk about the sense of catharsis that Brad describes in the book. How much do you get the sense from reading the book that he changed as a person over the course of his journey? He mentions that there's an element of self-help, and that, you know, for him, this was a voyage of discovery about himself as much as about learning about their wax packers themselves. So how much do you think he changes from the beginning to the end of the book? We'll start with you, Rob.
If I'm honest, I really don't think there is an awful lot of change. Brad on page one is very similar to Brad at the end. Now, he's maybe had some revelations about the players, but I don't think he himself really has changed an awful lot. Yes, there's an element of a move to closeness with his own father, which I think is very important part to the book and where it links in. I think completely accidental, but I don't really think Brad learns anything as such. I don't think he becomes a better person or a worse person or anything for it. I think we what we most learn is more about how we see baseball players. And I think I think that goes for the stretch for time as well. I think in maybe 20 years ago, you would watch a documentary, and then 10 years ago, you would watch a video clip for a couple of minutes. Now we consume everything through GIFs. And I think that's very much how we now consume our baseball players as well. I don't think we really give enough time to the person behind the baseball player. We consume the baseball player as a GIF. He is a snapshot of doing what he does. We don't even see the 10 minutes, unless it's a major scandal, 10 minutes of what's going on. Like, how many of the team you support, how many of the players could you say if they have kids or wives, or, you know, if they, where they actually come from? You don't have that anymore. And I have a feeling that Brad sort of is tapping at the fact that we have this GIF culture, this instant must have all the information that we want, but not necessarily the wider information. I think he's kind of tapped through that, and that the way we consume baseball isn't slow. It isn't the way it perhaps was 20 years ago. I think that's the main thing he's learned throughout it, is that these people are people. They're not just gifts.
I mean, I agree with you. I think the thing is though, that when you said about how much we know about the players, I think what we know about the players is a very much sanitized, packaged version of what they want us to know about them. So it's something that they might have on their social media profiles, or something that the club's official social media platforms puts out about them, you know, or that TV companies kind of, or MLB.com, MLB TV kind of put out about them. So these snippets about them, and then obviously they themselves can remain very, very private. And we can choose to consume that and take it or not. But yeah, I do completely agree with you. I think Brad comes to realize that what he thought baseball players were at the beginning of the book is different to what he thinks baseball players are now, based on having spent so much time with so many of them. What are your thoughts, Jason?
You know, I thought Brad came out as a better person. I definitely think he built some confidence up, because he, again, had to go drive cross country, you know, with guys he had texted and emailed and come down to and kind of said, hey, let's go meet up. And again, I think a lot of those guys were just happy that somebody remembered the career. I mean, these weren't really big name guys. So, you know, just to go and shoot the shit with them would be pretty good. I think a lot of stuff got left out of the book. Probably some stories he probably was asked not to retell, because I've met a couple of former players through friends, and you know, the stories they tell you in person are completely different than what you hear in the public. But you know, when he went to go to the golf course, say he was going to go buy a house in Florida, you know, this has happened to maybe see Carlton Fisk, who might be in the clubhouse for the hour he's there. You know, for him, it sounded like that was a big deal for him. You know, he wasn't a good liar. He really had to put himself out there. You know, he wasn't dressed the part. He showed up in a beat up Accord. You know, so I think for him, that was probably a huge deal to actually go put himself out like that and really try to be there to get these guys to talk to him. So, for him, I think he came out a better person out there and realized he could probably do a few more things than he thought he could previously.
Definitely.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That's really true, that he'd grown in terms of like growing in confidence. Because also it just made me think, actually, that the thing I don't think I had appreciated until now is that he not only did he interview the players, but he interviewed a lot of family and friends, and he did a huge amount of research, all of which takes a certain confidence and bravery and assertiveness to do. Like, he did a heck of a lot. There are undoubtedly, you know, 100 more interviews that aren't in the book that he must have done in order to fill the pages.
And he really did shoot his shot as well, you know, like he was really ballsy with some of the questions that he asked to people, you know, about their past, which were, you know, which must have taken quite a lot of courage. You know, the situation, he must have kind of taken a good read on the situation at the time, because that it could have come out really badly, and some of the responses he might have got would have been, you know, potentially really detrimental to the relationships he was trying to build with these guys. So, you know, I completely agree with you there, Jason. It's something I hadn't thought that much about, how he grew in confidence. I thought it was really interesting how he kind of grew in awareness. And we've talked a little bit about how he thought about baseball players at the beginning and then how he thinks about them at the end. I think even in the book's conclusion, he says, do we have more in common with professional baseball players than we realize? I think that he became more aware of the sport of baseball, and in learning about what happens to people after baseball, I think that he became aware of how rudimentary or how kind of vocational the sport of baseball is, that it's an industry and it churns people up, and you know, people go into it and they come out of it. And I don't know if that's still the case now, but it's certainly, he gives that impression of baseball in the 60s and 70s and 80s as being like that. And I thought that was really, really interesting.
So to give you an example of that, so I was going to try to walk on at Oregon State University, and I had a meeting with the coach. And it wasn't even the coach. It was like the assistant coach. And he basically said, look, we'll put you in the bullpen. We're going to throw you for 2 years so your arm falls off. And if you're still good enough to make the team, we'll maybe give you a scholarship. And so, you know, that's the way that they look at it. You know, you're just an arm out there till you fall off. So if you can, you know, grind your way through there, you know, you can make it. But, you know, you're talking about guys who are pros, that they really grind their way out there through injuries and stuff like that. And, Jaime talked about that. You know, he said he was really talented, but just never could put it together. And that's the hardest part for those guys, because it's just consistent failure.
And it makes you realize how phenomenally talented and devoted the people that make it to the top are. You know, they're the top 1% of the top 1%, you know, these guys that actually make it. So yeah, it's really interesting. Did anyone pick up on the Gary Pettis thing, you know, with the Houston Astros not being able to, them not allowing him to talk to the media? I thought that was quite interesting, knowing what we now know about the Astros. Sure. So I just realizing there's four people in this pack that he didn't actually get to talk to. So, I mean, he's worked it really well to make it to make these guys still a part of the story. I thought it was really interesting, really clever device to devote himself to the search for these guys. I wonder if he, I mean, there's no, I'm sure he had no illusions that he was going to get to talk to Carlton Fisk. Mm. Maybe an extremely long shot to be able to talk to Vince Coleman and Dwight Gooden. But I really appreciate, I think it's to the book's benefit that he keeps this in there. It's part of the story, that kind of. And in fact, the for me, one of the most well written and enjoyable scenes in the book is that Florida golf resort where he rocks up. And I just think, I mean, it ties into what we mentioned in the interview about having a filmic quality. That for me, more than any other scene, I can just see that in front of me in my, you know, the scene that being played out in front of me. I want to talk about the hypothetical film version of the Wax Pack. In your eyes, who would write the screenplay and who would direct and who would play Brad? And I'm going to start Phil off on this one because you've got an interesting twist on it, haven't you?
Yeah, I chickened out of answering this question. I could see it as a Netflix documentary instead. That, yeah, over 15 episodes or looking at each of the players and going back to that golf course and trying to rebuy a house, I think could still work in a documentary format for sure.
But would it be dramatized? Would it actually be?
Yeah, maybe that scene, that the golf scene in particular. Yeah, that could be dramatized. Yeah,
because for me, I could see it as a Netflix series, but as an adapted fictionalization. You know, I could see it as an actual adaptation rather than it being a documentary. I still think it worked really well as a film. Does anyone want to put their necks on the line and go for a director or an actor? What about you, Rob?
Yeah, I had a good thought about it. I do see it as a major Hollywood epic. And I started off thinking, all right, it's going to be a biopic. And then I thought, no, this isn't a biopic, because as much as this has serious themes, this isn't a serious book. It's a bit silly. It's a bit fantastical. And it has huge sort of overly, you know, big characters. And I thought, what better way, like, make it a Coen Brothers film. I could totally see a Coen Brothers film. Where it's this picaresque journey where these guys just pop up and they are larger than life. And it doesn't have to be real. It doesn't have to be real at all. It can be larger than life. And you can have flashbacks. You know, I crossed through at one point thinking it could be a Tarantino, but maybe not quite enough blood in it for that. So I ended up with a Coen Brothers film, and I thought my leading man, I thought, Brad's a good-looking guy. Let's not lie. He's a good-looking guy. And you're trying to think who could fill that. And I went through Jake Gyllenhaal, Ewan McGregor maybe. And I came to settle on Matt Damon. I think Matt Damon in a Coen Brothers film is how I see this book. It's a twist, but that's how I want it.
What about you, Jason? I'm going to keep mine to the end. Go on, Jason.
You know, Rob stole my thunder. I was going to say a Coen Brothers movie as well.
Yes.
I think they would do just a fantastic job with the whole thing. But I see the leading man, I think Paul Rudd. You know, you're gonna have some
that's a really good shout.
That's the answer.
Yeah, that's a really good shout. That's a really good shout. I also, well, the thing is, I've got two answers. Coen Brothers, absolutely, absolutely. But I'm not sure if I would want it to be that kind of, like you mentioned, the larger than life, these kind of jumping out of the screen characters. I don't know if I would be happy with that in what I see as the film. I was thinking, I want the humor. I also want a bit more warmth. I think the Coen Brothers can be a little bit cold at times, a little bit too darkly comic. So I went for Richard Linklater for my screenwriter and director, and I went for Jake Gyllenhaal as well. I thought it'd be really good at this. I actually thought, because I agree with you in terms of looks. I was thinking, I don't know if you have seen the show Community. Yeah. I was thinking maybe the guy who plays Abed. I don't even know his name, the actor who plays him. I'll put it in the show notes. But I was thinking maybe him, just on looks and on comedy. But I don't think he has the, I don't think he has the kind of the gravitas of a Gyllenhaal. So I'm going to stick with that. Okay, and then there's the last question to wrap up then. And we've kind of touched on this a little bit, talking about how baseball is different now to how baseball was in the 1980s. But one of the things I really liked about your interview with Brad, Rob, was that you opened an actual pack of cards. Was it 2019 cards that you did?
2019 opening day cards, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I mean, because you've already done that, I'm not going to go over it again. I'm going to say, in a more hypothetical sense, if you could pick any player, any one player playing baseball today or not playing baseball in 2020, as it turns out with the stoppage, you're going to catch up with this person in 30 years on a wax pack style trip. Who do you pick and why? And I'll start with you, Jason.
You know, I thought long and hard about this, and like you said, everything's kind of been sanitized. So I thought the perfect person would be Joey Votto. Mm. Just because he's been a heel, he plays it up well. You know, he'd probably be a very interesting person to tell some stories to. And then of course, you know, you could talk hitting with him all day long. You know, I think he's really kind of a student of the game, and I think it'd be a fun catch up with him 30 years later to see where he's gone.
I'd say he definitely.
That's the thing he says, though. Trust anything. It's that smoke and mirrors. He'd be a very interesting character.
Take it with a pinch of salt. But I think he would actually give you the time. I think he would definitely meet with you. I think he'd definitely talk to you. From what I know about him, I think he'd probably give you the time of day, which would be quite cool. How about you, Phil?
I thought long and hard about this. And I also actually ended up being inspired by Rob's chat. I ended up going on eBay and buying a pack of Topps baseball cards. But I couldn't actually, and inspired by the book as well, I couldn't actually get the 1986 ones, but I have just spent £12 on buying a Topps a wax pack from 1985. So I'm quite excited to see who I get in that. But of players who are playing today, I took the same approach, really, which is thinking about somebody who I think would be just a really good person to chat to. And I went with Daniel Murphy. I think he's had a fascinating career, been involved in some controversies, but seems like a nice guy. And I'm sure would have a lot of stories to tell and would also give his time up to do it as well.
Good. Just another good shout. How about you, Rob?
I went through a couple. Sort of had a superstar. I was thinking Chris Archer because he's been the peak. And then he's sort of come off that peak. And I've got a feeling his career is going to charge towards, you know, long-term journeyman. You know, he's going to bounce around for a while. But then I actually moved off that and I settled on Tony Kemp. Because one of the glorious things about the Wax Pack is it's not the absolute superstars. It is the other guys. And also he was a bit part player in the Astros scandal. So he was there. He was for that team. He wasn't the everyday player. He was utility guy. You know, he sort of replaced Altuve every now and then. But he was there. So I think that's the big story, the scandal that sort of gives a bit of narrative to his story when you speak to him. So I'm going to go with Tony Kemp.
Fair enough. Good shout. I went with Mike Yastrzemski because he's someone who came into the top level, you know, to the major leagues pretty late, but has always had this incredibly famous grandfather sort of almost hanging around his neck, you know, this level of expectation on him from when he's first come into baseball. And he's only now, you know, into his mid to late 20s, kind of got to the stage where he's getting regular game time. And I think he'd be quite an interesting person. He comes across as quite an intelligent guy and also quite humble. And I think it'd be quite interesting to have that dynamic of someone who experienced quite a lot of failure in the early part of his career and not just relative failure, obviously, but not just in the context of being a professional baseball player, but in the context of having this incredibly successful grandfather as well. I thought that'd be quite an interesting one to look into in 30 years' time. So, I think that's pretty much it. I don't know if anyone's got anything else to say. I wanted to ask you, Jason, if you don't mind, just telling us a little bit about what it's like to collect baseball cards, it's something that I've always wanted to do. And I've got a couple of collections. I've got like a 93 Giants collection that I got on eBay just because that was the first year that I became interested in baseball. I thought it was quite a nice little thing to do. But I've been playing loads of MLB The Show this year, and it's the first time I've ever played it. And one of the things you do in Diamond Dynasty is actually collect cards. And I completely got addicted to it. I just don't know if I could... I don't know if I could do physical card collecting. I never thought I'd get into virtual card collecting, but... What's it like, and how much of your time does it consume? And you know, tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a collector.
So I probably bought my first pack of cards in '83, and just kind of bought them here and there when I ever had some lunch money or whatever like that. And then when the big we call it the junk era, which is about the mid 80s to about the mid 90s to late 90s. And they just were mass produced. There was all of a sudden there was 3, 4, 5 different companies producing them. And so you were able to get them, had more money. And it was about 89. You kind of really saw that. And it was with Upper Deck. And man, I spent so much money buying box after box of cards. And, you know, and then of course you have to figure out, do you want to sort it by team? Do you sort it by numerical order? Or, of course, that year you had like the Ken Griffey Jr. rookie that was huge. So you would buy multiple packs of that. And then there's the, I don't know how much you guys know about the 89 Fleer Billy Ripken card.
Nope.
So on the knob of the bat, it says fuckface.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So yes, so there was a limited run of about a month of those, and that, and so of course people were buying those like crazy, and we bought cards, and it kind of died off again with the strike in '94, and then of course with McGuire and Sosa kind of ramping things back up in '98, the craze took off again, so people started searching through, you know, boxes of cards to find those rookie cards from his USA card and Sosa's rookie card. And now the game's completely changed. It's all about, one of one cards. Whereas, you know, you talk about the 89 Upper Deck, there was millions of these cards produced. And it's just crazy to see how much has changed since I've really started collecting. So I can totally understand where you're coming from. You're like, I don't know where to collect or how to start or what to start. And it's just nuts now. Even now, like, I'm still kind of collecting from that junk era because I just don't have the money to buy. I mean, there's a transcendent Topps break, a box of that cards cost $22,000. So they were selling spots for $165 for one card, and the hopes to pick this one card out there. So, you know, it depends on how much money you have, and it's really kind of taken off now with the pandemic here, because there's a lot of people who just have time in their hands to go, oh, you know, I miss collecting cards in the 80s and 90s, and they're really kind of driving prices up right now. It's really like back of the way it was in the late 80s and the early 90s.
Well, that's a cool way to finish, and probably, and quite apt as well, actually, given that the book is all about collecting. It's interesting to hear. It's something that I can't imagine my wife would, you know, just be another thing. I don't even think I could countenance asking her to understand why I started collecting baseball cards. So I'm just going to give it a wide berth, but I do have the desire. I just don't have the inclination, I don't think. I'm going to have to wrap it up because we're running out of time. Thank you very much, everybody. I really enjoyed chatting to you, and I really enjoyed the book. All right, cheers.